Hey guys, thank you for tuning in. I really appreciate your time. Don't take that for granted. Just like I say every single time, your attention is really, really valuable to me. I appreciate the time you take. We have Doug Collins with us today again, who happily agreed to attend the second episode after we did the first one. It was really, really great. I learned a lot from Doug. And today we want to discuss a pretty important topic because, you know, this world is driven by numbers. And a lot of people are just questioning the ROI of good UX. So that's, we're not going to go, you know, too deep into the numbers, but we're just going to show at the high level with some real life examples how making bad products actually costs companies a lot of money. And we also going to try to understand the reasons for it and how to potentially drive organizations in a way to avoid making bad products and actually, you know, saving money and making more money. So Doug, welcome to the podcast. Super happy to have you. Why don't you say hi to everybody?
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in, and thank you for having me back on. It's always great to be here and talk with everyone. And this is our second attempt at recording this podcast. First one, we got wrapped up in a lot of math. And we're going to spare you the math now. So that's our goal. But you know, for everyone listening out there, if we start straying too much in the math, you know, throw the be the teachers and throw the erasers at us from across the room. Or that's what my teachers always did. Were your teachers eraser throwers if somebody was falling asleep or goofing off or?
No, I mean, I'm from Russia. I think there were a few cases where people got actually hit by a teacher with a stick. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they don't do that anymore. But back then, and it's not like, you know, you got whipped, right?
Right.
It would just be kind of like a slight kind of spanking with that pointer stick that they would, you know, use on the board, right?
Man.
So I think it happened a couple of times, but yeah, it's not like it's a everyday thing. But
yeah, well,
you just brought that up, and I remembered about it.
Well, but I mean, I don't think that's happened, you know, in at least in my school district where I am for, you know, 50 years at this point. So you,
well, this is US, you would get sued right away. In Russia,
right,
you can do whatever you want, right?
Yeah, that's a little bit scarier. I'm kind of glad now I didn't have that, because I probably would have gotten whacked a lot. And that's I was a good kid, but not a good student. So I'm not really sure how that all worked out, but at least I never got my knuckles wrapped. So I'll take that any day of the week. But yeah, so thanks everyone for tuning in, and I think this is going to be a fun conversation. We're going to have a good time. Try and keep it a little less structured and more fun. And you know, there's a lot to be said about the ROI of UX, and I think that. We have some good thoughts here, and I know that there were some pieces that you wanted to start on. So where do you want to start? Where should we start the conversation from?
So I prepared for the episode by, you know, taking a few notes. I looked at my Twitter feed because
I just say real fast, this is the difference in students that we were. You prepared for the episode, and I'm just winging it. So it's already showing right there.
Well, I mean, but, you know, it's it's not like I kind of sat down and, you know, spent dedicated amount of time preparing. I just, this thing was in my head all this time. And every time a dot would get connected, like, you know, I would remember about something and I would scroll through my Twitter feed and like, oh, you know, that's a good thing to bring up on the episode. So it was kind of a, you know, more of a relaxed type of preparation.
And I'm still feeling guilty, but go on.
Oh, no worries. I mean, you add a lot of value by, you know, creating the discussion, because otherwise I would be a crazy person talking to myself, right?
You know, I tried to do a one-person podcast at one point in time in a different part of my life, and it just sounded like a crazy guy yelling into a microphone. So even though it got a good reception, it felt a little weird. So I couldn't do that anymore. So yeah, definitely good to have two people at least. And we'll have to get Oksana on here with us at some point in time. We can have a good three-way conversation. That'll be a lot of fun to get the three
we
of us all talking.
Absolutely should do that. Yes.
Yeah.
We will have to sync on the time zones because she's in Europe.
Yeah.
So unless we start a little later and she gets up at 5 a.m. or something, but yeah, we'll certainly discuss that.
Yeah.
So one thing that kind of the huge one, I'll put the biggest piece that I know on the plate right away. We both follow Jared Spool, very awesome resource, UX resource to follow on Twitter, JM Spool, I think.
Yes.
And I ran into his article. I met him personally, but later after that, I ran into his article several years ago, like 2011 or even 2009, mm-hmm. where he... I assume he was consulting a, judging by the numbers, a pretty major company. And the problem was that it was an e-commerce operator, and they designed the UI and the logic around checking out the shopping cart,
right,
which is the most important piece. That's how you make money, in mm-hmm. a very... confusing way. They made certain assumptions that user would either log in without any problems if it's an existing user, or they will just not bother, not mind creating a new account because presumably, again, their assumption, it would help them kind of in the future as they shop again, not to refill out all the information, which are, pretty bad assumptions in my opinion.
Right.
And so long story short, Jared and his team, or maybe it was him alone, I don't know, they went in, they analyzed the interface, they analyzed the database as well, which was kind of a learning piece for me, because you don't just kind of look at the UI and make certain assumptions. You look at the database, shopping cart abandonment, at what point people stopped, how many times they tried to recover the password, before they gave up, and those kind of things. So a lot of that was recorded in the database. So long story short, they did a great job. Is that a pizza guy?
Yeah, I'm sorry. And to everyone who's listening out here, we have our pizza delivery man. What was your name?
Mike.
Mike, our pizza delivery guy. Mike, I'm recording a podcast, so apology for the slip up here, but we are going to give you a nice tip so that.
And if he wants to say hi to his parents, that's fine too.
Yeah, exactly. All right, and I don't think Mike can hear you, but we will definitely make sure Mike is well taken care of here. Thank you so much, and so first podcast appearance here, Mike.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, congratulations. You can now put it on. You can put it on your IMDb
on the resume. And
We're talking about user experience. So good things, bad things, kind of difficulties people have in using things. Do you have like a favorite website or not a favorite website?
I use Twitch.com.
Twitch? Oh, so you're a big streamer fan, right?
Remember how we talked about Twitch episode?
We talked about Twitch on our last episode. What do you like about Twitch? What makes it good for you?
It's just fun. People play games, interact with them.
Right, yeah, it's all the interaction, right? Getting it, but being able to interact with the people that are out there playing and that sort of thing. So.
Yes.
Yeah, cool. Well, thanks so much. I apologize for the unscripted podcast interview, but thank you so much for bringing me my pizza, and I hope you have a wonderful evening.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So there we go. We have a Twitch fan bringing me pizza, and apologies to my, or I shouldn't say to our listeners out there who have to sit and listen to me get my pizza delivered, but that was supposed to be here an hour ago, so we didn't exactly get done, but it's not Mike's fault, so Mike got a good tip, and now I will have pizza for after the podcast, which will be great.
Awesome. So, well, we yeah. have two good things here. First, you got your pizza, so you'll have some kind of dinner. And right. Second, I think it was awesome because we actually just got like real validation of what we talked about in the last episode. We made an assumption that Twitch is, you know, getting popular. I mean, it was not an assumption. It's, you know, data supported. But there you go. You know, we confidently talked about Twitch and how it's overtaking real sports in terms of attention. And there you go. I mean, the guy that shows up on our episode is the Twitch fan. So,
you know, we're gonna have to order more pizza in the future and see if we can get Mike to come back and talk on our podcast for a bigger tip. So, but yeah, you know, it's interesting to see that validation there. We're talking a lot about streaming on the last episode, and there he goes. That's it. But yeah, so the point I mean you're making about Jared too. Before Mike came across and yep. happily joined in the podcast for a brief moment, was very well taken. I think you know, Jared there did a great job of showing the potential value of having that UX presence. You know, and certainly Jared is great at that. That's kind of what he does. Is goes to those organizations and you know, points out where they can be successful. And you know, he is the ultimate I shouldn't say part-timer, but ultimate contractor, right? You know, he comes in and sign that contract and let him show you where things can get better. You know, other people out there have made a living doing that. Joe Natoli, one of my favorite UXers out there, has been doing that for years, as well as teaching people and you know, building that UX knowledge within the community. Sarah Duty does a lot of the same type of stuff as well. So it's interesting to see that, you know, even bringing on somebody for a short period of time can have a big impact, and that's possible to make a career out of that. And I'm pretty envious of them. Maybe I'll get there someday, but I'm not there yet. So you never know.
Yeah, and the most interesting piece is the number, because I don't think I mentioned the number. After they fixed the problem, the revenue, the sales went up by 300 million in the, you know, next 12 months, or I mean, whatever the measurements were. I'm sure they compared, you know, comparable periods of time. So, you know, before and after. And again, I don't know what that percentage is to the total revenue. They could have been selling, you know, 5 billion online or 50 billion online. So obviously 300 million would be a different percentage, but regardless of the percentage, that's a hell of a lot of money.
I would like to have 300 million more than what I have right now.
Yeah. And you know, I would also hope that Jared signed the contract that, you know, whatever increase in sales you have, I want like, you know, 1% of that.
That's the ultimate way of going, yeah, just toss me 1%, right? It's the residuals for UXers, kind of like when you sign on to a movie, you get those points at the box office. You got to get that for UX work. I think I'm going to try and write that into my next contract that I sign. So we'll see what happens.
Well, yeah, just like salespeople, right?
Right.
Do you have, I have a few other examples that we're going to talk about, but do you have any examples from your work, or, you know, whether it's a corporate job or maybe you did something on the side where certain UX tasks were executed, you know, in not in the best fashion, and then the company suffered bad customer experience, a lot of returns or a lot of rework, which takes obviously a lot of developer and UX. I mean, a lot of people in the organization, kind of cross-functional thing, right. Developing a product and rebuilding a product. Do you have any examples from your experience?
I mean, it's tough because a lot of my career has been made about doing UX work on the front end and preventing a lot of that from going on. We did see that quite a bit in my current job in the financial services world, where we had an existing system that needed to be reworked, and some of the options were, I should back up and say this existing system we were transferring over from a desktop-based application to a web app. And some of the questions was, how much do we change the functionality, right? going from one to the other. There are certain constrictions that you have on a desktop application and certain abilities that you have there that don't exist within that web app, right? So how far do you go in making that changes? And the question is, well, how much time do you want to spend, you know, seeing whether or not this is a good idea or not? My big disappointment with that whole process was that we were so focused. I came in the middle of it, which wasn't a great place for me to come in. At that point in time, they had already kind of started to port things over, and I was more just doing the UI work for that piece, where I was just saying, okay, how should this look, and sort of what some of the best practice piece that we can apply to make it work well. But what I would have liked to have done with that is to look at each feature individually and say, A, are people using this? Because there was a lot that was going on that either we knew wasn't being used or we suspected wasn't being used. And B, if people aren't using it, why aren't they using it? As a matter of, they just don't know about it. Is it not easy to use? Is there something that they don't like about it? Or does it not serve their purpose? And based off that research, do the design based off of those pieces. I think for me, that was a big missed opportunity, simply because I wasn't afforded it. To have had an impact, and one that I'd like to go back and take a look at. I think our product would look very different at this point in time if we had done that piece, but it was not something that was a focus for us while we were going through that. The win for me, on the other hand, was my first job at Nordstrom, and I talk about this in my podcast with I was on with Joe Natoli. I talk about him being one of my favorite guys. I was lucky enough to be on his podcast. Mm-hmm. Which is making UX work, talking about how I got started when I was working on the phones at Nordstrom Bank as a call center rep. And we had a system there that was built in FrontPage 2004. And this was in 2009.
That ring is a bell. I know this software exists.
It was about as good as you might expect it to be. There was no search functionality. Everything that was as far as this giant list of procedures that all the call center reps had to look at for everything that they did, for credit limit increases, for reviewing fraud, for handling, you know, if somebody died on an account. Everything was just sort of randomly put into a category and alphabetized. So if you didn't know exactly what category something was in, you could be searching for it, you know, with a customer getting more and more impatient on the line for 10, 15 minutes, which was never a good idea. There were also a lot of tasks that we did that were just kind of repetitive. And we did a lot of work doing those tasks because we had to, you know, for instance, retype notes that we used a lot, you know. So, you know, in between phone calls, I sat down with Internet Explorer and Notepad and used the 10 to 15 to 20 seconds between calls to design, develop, and create a better system for the call center reps to, you know, be more effective at their jobs. And then once I had created that, I kind of monkeyed around a little bit and figured out that I could use my computer as sort of a server. Which made the internet security guys inside go a little crazy. But I was able to kind of host that up for the rest of my team that was there and do some testing with them to see what they liked about it and what they wanted to that happen. What eventually grew into was this platform that was designed to make everything better and easier for our customer service reps to use. And then eventually it was killed 3 or 4 or 5 different times. I was told to stop working on it by different people who, for whatever reason, you know, we talk about internal politics being a big thing.
Killed meaning taken off the market?
Right. Yeah. They told me to stop working on it. They said, it's not going to happen. Stop working on it. It's a security risk. It's blah, blah, blah. And I dutifully ignored them, where I probably shouldn't have. But worked on it for about 3-ish years, 3 or 4 years, before I finally got a chance to pitch it to our CEO, who liked it so much. At the end of the pitch, he turned to the room, which was filled with other C-level executives and some of the managers that had told me to stop working on it, and asked, "Why aren't we doing this already?" And promoted me out from being in the call center to being a software engineer with the role of putting that together for the whole company to use. Over the course of time for that UX piece, I've estimated, I did some testing to see, you know, sort of what the value of this would be. And I figured that the way that I tested it is I used my system and then I used kind of the existing system. And I tested the difference between the amount of time it took for me to do different pieces, and then figured out using some metrics I had, sort of the average amount that I would save per call in terms of seconds. In the call center world, if you can save 5 to 10 seconds per call, that's huge. And we were saving an average of 34 seconds per call.
And that's something in the UI that would help prevent calls, or sorry, maybe I missed that.
No, definitely. It was a bit in call prevention, but it was mostly in completing the tasks that we were given more efficiently. So running through credit limit increase procedures more efficiently, reviewing accounts that had, applications for accounts that had been rejected that people were calling us to see if they could actually get approved. So the customer could make a purchase at the register, the cash register. You know, they're standing there with a $5,000 handbag and they're, you know, applying for a Nordstrom credit card. They're saying, why aren't we approved? Well, to go in and find, you know, the reason why they were declined and then to work through the process to see if you could clear that decline reason and actually get them approved for credit was, you know, kind of one of those pieces is kind of an example of sort of what was addressed by that. And when we put that all together and you know, figured out sort of different scenarios we had and the average amount of time that we were saving per call, I figured that by using the system that I had built, I was saving about 34 seconds per call. So every call that I took was 34 seconds shorter than what it was when I was using the old system. And so when you multiply that out, and again, I said we're going to stay away from math. I promise I'm going to stay away from math.
It's fine. You can just, you know, throw ballpark numbers, right? Like, saved $1 million by, right. Because, you know.
Well, and I don't want to get wrapped on the knuckles or anything either. So I'm watching you over there. But, you multiply everything out. We had a few hundred different, you know, a few hundred reps on the phones, you know, by their average salary, blah, blah, blah. It all averaged out that we would save about $7 million a year. And lost productivity and wages by implementing this system.
And that's something that your managers try to tell you not to do.
Yeah, exactly. They told me not to do that. Now, a big part of that was because I didn't have a number to throw in front of them and say, this is what the ROI should be. And there are different methods that you can use for that. I'm not going to go too much into that. But we were able to prove that, essentially it would have an average of about $7 million a year. I know that it was implemented and I know that it's still being used after I left the last time I heard, which was a year and a half ago. But assuming it's still up and running, I've saved the company more than $28 million by building and implementing that particular tool.
That's when you put that percentage into the contract. I want 0.5%.
Well, and Nordstrom, I should say, they're lovely people. They were great to work with. But one of the reasons why I left was because they didn't bump the salary up from a call center level employee to a software engineer level. So they're trying to, you know, pay me the same and have me do much more advanced work. And so that was a big part of the reason why I left. They were wonderful people. I wish I'd that hadn't come to that, but that's kind of the way it is sometimes.
That's how retail works, and I spent a few years there, and I said I'll do my best not to go back unless I really have to. I love retail. It's I love customer service. I absolutely love talking to customers when I was spending time in stores, learning about operations and things like that. And I made so many people happy by just creating awesome experience when they would come in with a problem and, you know, super pissed off, throwing F words around, like, you know, I will blow up your store kind of thing. but then they would just walk away apologizing and super happy. So it just, you know, made my day every time. But retail is with all the thin margins that they have, and all those crazy hours, and especially if they make you work on, assuming you're in the store, if they make you work, or in the call center for that matter, right. Like, you know, on Thanksgiving, right? You would be open on Thanksgiving, taking customers' calls. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, don't want to deviate too much from the subject.
But wait a second here. So you were actually, a retail associate at one point in time, or a manager, or?
I was not a retail associate, but that happened when I worked at Sears.
Sears, you worked for Sears too? I worked for Sears.
You did?
Yeah, I was, this is my glorious background because, you know, if you start as a call center employee, guaranteed you have a wonderful work history behind it. But I worked in the lawn and garden department. I worked in the sporting goods department. Before I was working there when I got the call that I got the internship with the Denver Broncos to go work in their new media department on their website.
Wow. That's really cool. Before I went to corporate, they put me in the store, but I was never an associate. It was they slapped a district manager title on me. And I spent time in the stores just, you know, observing and helping customers and learning the operations. So I would go into the corporate to do, you know, corporate things, knowing how, you know, the stores work. And I think it was very important.
Absolutely. And you know, it's a great perspective to have, having worked there. And I did a lot of retail work. So I'm not sure. I'm sure that makes me a lot less glamorous in the eyes of some people. But you know what? I'm proud about it. It was a big. And I know we don't want to get too much off track, but I have to tell you this story we can kind of link to a manager role, and I'll see if I can link this back to some UX piece here. But it was Black Friday, so this is a holiday story, a holiday retail story. And I was working as I was a store operations manager for Circuit City. Back in the day, and Black Friday.
We wrote a book on Circuit City with my boss, but we can talk about that later.
I'm so sorry. I was there at the end when, for the last couple of years when things were really going downhill. And this was, I can't remember if it was the last Black Friday they were open or the second to last one, but one way or another, they actually had some really good traffic. There were a lot of people in the door. And you know, being a manager on Black Friday is just, it's controlling the chaos, ever so slightly as much as you can.
At a Sears store on the Black Friday. I know what that is.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. anybody who's been out and shopping on a Black or working on a Black Friday, no less, knows where we're coming from. And in this case, so we had lines that were wrapping around the store. One of our registers was down. And this guy pulled me aside and he said, hey, do you work here? And I go, yeah, I'm one of the managers. And he's very polite. And he said, sorry, sir, what can I do for you? And he says, I've been waiting in this line for an hour and a half. And I know that he hadn't, but, you know, I'm waiting in this line an hour and a half. And why is this taking so long? I'm so sorry. One of our registers is down. Obviously, there's a lot of people here. We're moving. We have every register open that we can. We're moving as fast as I can. I promise we'll get to you quickly. And he kind of rumps and turns around. And I go, okay. So I had to go back to the office to grab some paperwork. And as I get back in my office, the phone rings. And one of our customer service reps said that there was a call for a manager on the phone. And so I pick up the phone and answer it. And it was the same guy who was calling to complain about me. And he didn't realize my name because I answered that. I said, this is Doug. How can I help you? And Doug was on my name tag when I was out there. And he said, I wanted to complain about one of your managers and blah, 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 blah. I let him talk to me. And I gave him the same, exact same reason. At the end, he was, oh, this has been so great. Thank you so much. I feel so much better about things now. And please tell me you'll tell that guy off for me. I said, yeah, okay, I'll go ahead and do that and just let him go. Maybe that speaks a little bit to the user experience of Black Friday. And I'm sure we could do maybe that's something we do next holiday season, is talk about the user experience of shopping in stores and mm-hmm. how that's ever changing and growing, because you wouldn't have that. Quite the same way now. Things are, you know, one of the things Nordstrom does to give some kudos back to Nordstrom at their rack stores. If you have, I think it's less than 5 items, you can, and you're paying with a credit card, you can go to any employee anywhere in the store and say, hey, ring me up. They have little handheld scanners there that you can, you know, give them your merchandise. Mm-hmm. So ring everything up and scan you right there, get your receipt, you're out the door. It's changing. Cool. Yeah. So I don't know if that would have, if that would be the case that you'd have
an
experience.
And this is another, this is a good example of return on investment. If you design the phone, the application on that device that allows associates to do that, and you create a process around that, you will check out those people in the store, you will make money, because a lot of people will walk away without buying if the line is too long. But if they, especially if they have, you know, two or three items, like, you know, I just don't need it that bad, I'm not going to stand here for another hour. So right. that's a great example of how not only how you design a product better, but how you actually create an additional product and the process to capture that potentially lost revenue if the customer just simply walks away.
Right, absolutely. And you wonder how many sales they lost by people walking out the door. And that's one of those things you could say, hey, let's try this at a store or two and see what the return on investment might be. You know, maybe we get a prototype out there and we do some research on it. I believe, I might be mistaken about this, but I believe that these are just modified iPhones that the Nordstrom reps are using. So it's not like this is a, you know, some sort of weird hardware that they're designing for. They're making an iPhone app.
Yeah, you basically, Target does the same thing. That you just need your own proprietary software that will do those things. And you obviously need to set up a process, train people and things like that. But yeah, it's all doable. And so going back to what you talked about in terms of ROI, this is actually one of the biggest areas where, because I used to do a lot of that kind of cost-benefit analysis at Ameriprise, and we actually had a project on a call center. We analyzed, we listened to the calls, we understood, you know, what was the purpose of the calls and how we could have avoided that call or how we could have reduced the time. And it goes actually connects to one of the notes that I made for the episode, that corporate software just gets so little attention from people, but it just creates so much impact on, you know, first of all, it directly translates into money. Like, you know, the more time on the phone you spend, it just like every second is money, every minute is a dollar or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And then also the attrition, when employees just get overwhelmed with bad design, and it just kind of becomes their miserable daily work that they have to deal with clunky software that doesn't work half of the time, or just confusing, especially if, for example, there's an update to the software and now they have to relearn. There's so much money that gets burned in the background, you know, starting from employees investing a lot more time in working with the software that directly translates into dollars. And then you have those, you know, burnout employees or people who are offered better jobs and they say, you know, screw it, I'm not going to look at this screen anymore. I'd rather go and work for somebody else, even if it's, you know, a couple of dollars an hour less or something like that. So one of the things that I also wanted to speak about, and I don't know if we will find an answer, but with companies like Apple, Google, and all those guys who have so much cash in the bank that, you know, most companies can only dream of, they can hire the best UX developers, the best, UX designers, best developers, and everything like that. And for some reason, somehow, it's just unbelievable how poor their the UX of some of their products is. And one of the thoughts that I kind of entertained when I thought about that, I was thinking whether it's... So one thing that I try to connect it to is that most decisions are made by people in organizations at the, obviously, you know, C-level and VP level and directors. And I noticed that most of those people are left brain people, which is
right.
You know, legit thing to be. We are divided into left brainers and right brainers, and you know,
and no brainers. Don't
and no brainers, right?
Proud member.
We wish. And so left brain people, they are logical and they need data, and they are just they are not creative people by nature. And right brain people, they are creative, and. One of the exceptions, I don't know if I can come up with another example, but, you know, such a prominent example is Steve Jobs, where he, I mean, 100% he was a right brainer, because, you know, to have such a deep vision for UX and paying attention to every little pixel on the screen, you just cannot be, you know, a finance person or a developer person. So, you know, if you are a finance driven, numbers driven, code driven, 100%, you know, over 99% of the cases, you would be a left brain person. And so I was kind of wondering, because maybe that's one of the reasons why, because I'm sure with all the money that they have, they would hire the best UX people, but then those UX people just do not have enough freedom of those executive decisions to say, you know, that's how it's going to be. And those left brain thinkers, they are not able to properly understand what that means, the repercussions of, you know, making the product too complex instead of keeping it simple. And also those people are driven by short-term incentive pressure, right? You know, we need to ship this product tomorrow. And I remember there were a few times when I think Steve Jobs delayed a couple of products. Maybe I'm making things up, but I think he at least once delayed a product because it was not good enough.
Right.
It was written somewhere. While, you know, with recent developments, we just, you know, they just push raw products, and we see that with every iOS, every new iOS version, that they just do not... They just stick to the schedule, and you know, things happen. But then those people who are in charge of those executive decisions, they do not understand the UX piece of that and the importance of that, and then they are pressured by all those deadlines and short-term incentives that, you know, if we push this product out this quarter, we'll sell one last week of this quarter and my bonus will go up because of those sales. You know, if we push it next quarter, which is a week later, it will not be recorded in my bonus paycheck this quarter. Well, I mean, something like that, right?
Right.
So
right.
Those are kind of my thoughts. I don't know if you have a strong opinion on that.
Liberal arts majors, that's the first thing that comes to my mind. and you'll have to stick with me a little bit, because I know that that's kind of random, but you know, talk about the left brain and right.
That's the major of Steve Jobs, right? He was
right.
In liberal arts,
right? Exactly. You know, it's the left brain and the right brain people. So for anyone out there who's listening to this and going, what the hell is liberal arts, it's essentially having the idea of having a well-rounded education that you don't necessarily specialize in one particular field, but you learn to think about things from a number of different perspectives, scientific, historical, you know, mathematical perspectives, having a good grounding in a lot of different areas. The liberal arts major is kind of the epitome of somebody who can be both left-brained and right-brained. They can think about something from a scientific perspective or an artistic perspective. And I feel like liberal arts majors have always gotten a bad rap. If one of your friends out there is saying, "Oh, I want to major in liberal arts," you know, the first, you know, instinct is to slap them beside the head and say, "You'll never get a job doing that." And, you know, it's like you know, the old joke. What does a liberal arts major say after they get their degrees? Would you like fries with that? And that's obviously not the route they want to go. But I talk about this a bit at length in other places, but I think the variety of people that come into UX is a really big strength for the industry as a whole, because we get a lot of different perspectives. We have people that are coming here from the perspective of people who are former C-level managers, from people who have been accountants, from people who have been scientists and archaeologists, to people that were housewives and artists, journalists, and really bringing in those different perspectives. And I think that having that within an organization is imperative. Having that within a team is imperative. And sometimes my suspicion, and I have nothing to back this up on, so I'm violating my own data-driven principles, but my suspicion is that some of these larger organizations, Microsoft, Google, Apple, et cetera, they want to hire from the best schools, the schools with best track records, and that means hiring people who have that focused degree in human-computer interactions, having a master degree in that, you know, same type of route, psychology, that sort of thing, who come from those very sort of left-sided, mentalities. I don't know that we have enough of those right-brain people in the world, which seems like a bit of a paradox when you think about what it is that we do. But I think at the higher levels, at the higher level organizations, you begin to get sort of that left-leaning structure within the UX teams, and that mission of understanding the user and being able to fight for their needs, fight for their goals, fight to solve their problems gets lost a bit in sort of the conversation we've been having in that dollars and cents sort of piece, because there is very much that divide there, as you say. So it would be very interesting for me to spend some time to track down, some of these teams and see kind of how they're composed. And I'm sure we'd never get cooperation to do that. So that would be interesting to even attempt. Certainly an interesting thought that, I kind of wonder how many of these people are like me, who I went to a liberal arts high school in Lakewood that was very much a college prep, liberal arts, get you a well-grounded education. I come from a journalism background. I've been doing design for longer than I've been doing any sort of development work. I don't have a college degree. That's the other thing. I dropped out when from college. I went 3 years and I never got my degree. So that's and here I am, I should say, having had a successful career so far, and hoping to have more success down the road.
Good for you.
Yeah, well, but I've done it by focusing on the user and fighting for those problems and fighting for that. And I kind of wonder how often that gets missed in those larger organizations. And it'd be an interesting research project to work on.
Well, you actually brought up a good point, and I connected it to one of the notes that I put down for the episode. Both, the liberal arts piece and the ROI. So what came to mind is, do you remember this whole Samsung Galaxy Note 4 fiasco? I think it was the 4 where batteries were exploding and they were banned from the planes and everything.
I don't think it was the 4. I think it was the 7 or 8 or something like that. But yeah, whatever it was, where Samsung was had the battery issues where everything was randomly exploding. You couldn't bring your phone on a plane or really even put it in your pocket safely.
So I think it was the Note, and the Notes notes were slightly slower in numbers than the actual Galaxy phone. They were kind of running behind, so I think it was Note 4 or something, but doesn't matter.
Galaxy Note 7. I've got Google here in front of me helping me out. Thank you, Google.
Oh, cool, awesome. Yeah.
Galaxy Note 7. But yes, go ahead.
Awesome.
Anyway,
I think at this point it's been proved that the issue was the battery, the fact that they made it so thin, so small, that it just kind of exceeded that, architectural capacity or whatever that is. And just you just certain things just cannot be smaller than, certain numbers, right? And I think this, and we can only imagine the number of dollars that were just, you know, just went down the toilet when this whole thing started, and all the way until it ended, from, you know, all the returns and wasted money for product. I mean, you can imagine it's like hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions, right?
Well, I'm sure.
And so this is your ROI number, which means you could have made this money, but you didn't. You actually lost it. So, you know, ROI can be making money and not losing money. If you did not lose, right. It's also ROI.
Well, and the thing that drove me crazy about that was the whole argument of people want thinner phones at the expense of, you know, possibly them catching on fire. You know, how much research was actually done? Because, you know, the more that I read about that, I could not find a single source saying that phone thickness was a determining factor for people buying it within a reasonable amount compared to competitors. So nobody's going to be walking around with a brick. I'm not saying that. But, you know, how much research was actually done to see that this was an important piece? I can't tell that any ever was, and I've never been able to find any research supporting it as a need that anybody had.
So, and you actually, what you just said, you just hit that on right on the head, that nail. That's exactly what I was going to say.
Oh,
so,
good. Oh, okay. Well, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. So what I think is that left brain people, who were, first of all, Samsung had a problem to compete with Apple, like, you know, smaller, thinner, faster, bigger, I mean, whatnot, right? And I think they just went overboard, and the left brain thinking, the competition, short-term incentives, instead of kind of seeing the long-term strategy. And that proves the point that they did not have enough people in those higher ranking executive decisions layers, where somebody with the liberal arts views would say, or at least would question, like, do you think that people actually care that, you know, that extra half millimeter thinness is actually a selling point? Like, you know, well, where's the research? How do we, and maybe they, you know, potentially they went to some users and said, you know, would you buy a phone if you had a phone with, you know, 4 millimeter thickness and the 3.5 millimeter thickness, which phone would you buy? And maybe that person said, well, I would buy a thinner phone. And maybe that was the extent of their research, right? Which obviously doesn't make any sense.
No.
So,
yeah.
And I think this is a great example of how not thinking rationally in terms of, like, you know, questioning things and building not bad products. It was not a bad product, but it was hazardous products and dangerous products. And
I consider that a bad product. I mean,
yeah. So
yeah, that's the definition of a bad. If a bad product is going to kill me and 200 strangers on an airplane,
I mean, it depends on how we define UX, right? Like, whether it's a beautifully designed, which I'm sure it was beautifully designed, but it was not practical, which is another critical piece of the user experience. So I think this is a great example. I'm looking at the timing. I think we'll probably, you know, spend a couple more minutes and we'll probably be wrapping up, not to kind of roll over 1 hour.
Sure.
One other thing that and we'll probably, you know, record another episode where I will use some of the notes that will not be voiced today. But one thing that I think makes a lot of sense, and I think it would be a good way to kind of end that episode to add a lot of value right at the end. It kind of goes back to simplicity and how making products more complex actually costs you more money. But it's not one-for-one correlation, and I'll explain. So, for example, if you want to add, if you build a product and you need 3 features total on this product, and, you know, maybe a third feature is not necessary, but you still kind of, you know, decide to put it in there. So it's not really going to cost you one-to-one. Like, if one feature costs you, you know, $10 to build and deploy, it doesn't mean that all three features will cost you 30. Because
right.
I think every additional feature that you add adds a lot more than just, you know, another one of those, you know, 10,000. Because it creates complexity, it creates user confusion. You need to train the user, you need to train your customer support, because, you know, all of a sudden this third feature is now in the context of those other two features. They may not be completely independent of each other, right? And then the third feature you build in, you may break something in the second or the first feature. And so it's such a such a huge ecosystem, which is, I think, super underestimated, because maybe that's how people think simplistically, you know, oh, you know, if that drop down menu costs us, you know, $1,000 to build, if we put two more, it will cost us $3,000. Probably not going to happen this way. Probably going to be a lot more. So those are kind of my thoughts, where simplicity again is so first of all, you are spending a lot of money building those additional features. Second, you are making bad financial assumptions, thinking that you know, if it's three times one, then it's, you know, three. It's not three, it's probably five or six or seven. So if that makes sense, I kind of wanted to voice that point at the end of the episode. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, one of the things that I did a very small amount of preparation, so I shouldn't say I did nothing, but you know, one of the things that we talk about when we talk about sort of the costs that that UX saves, when we think about developers and how they spend their time, there was a report back from the IEEE, which is the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. IEEE, you know, wonderful acronym. But they put out a report back in 2005 that said that developers spend about 50% of their time working on reworking failed software. So whether these are features or entire pieces of software that have failed for whatever reason, going back and fixing those problems. And they gave this big list of why software projects fail. And it was 12 different points to it. And UX practices help mitigate about four of those points. Most of the points revolved around that UX could affect revolved around things like identifying and understanding user problems, concerns, and mitigating internal politics and struggles and that sort of thing. And, you know, to that point, that UX does a great job of understanding the problems and advocating for the user, as that is our main goal, right? We shouldn't be, to throw it back to Jared, and to paraphrase something that he had said, you know, we shouldn't be falling in love with our solutions. We should be falling in love with the user's problems, right?
Well, absolutely.
Right. You know, being able to understand those problems, advocate for the user, advocate for fixing those problems, not only from the perspective of the user, but also for the business, is what really starts to make that ROI argument much more powerful. So, you know, I think that's kind of my thoughts around those things. But, you know, if you can mitigate that 50% of the time that, you know, developers are spending working on failed software, that becomes a great large argument for you know, either building or expanding a UX team, which for anybody that visits our wonderful UX news magazine website, uxnewsmag.com, there will be an article coming up that I'm writing about that will have all sorts of math in it. So if you like UX and math, there will be all sorts of math talking about that. But using that and some other research is kind of the basis for how we put together an equation that we can give to those left brain people to say this is why we should be building a UX team. So for anybody that you know, tuned in tonight and was very disappointed by the lack of math, don't worry, I have you covered.
Well, so I think as a wrap up, I'll actually take your number, which is 50%, And I'll just spend a couple of minutes building a case for that, which I think should be valuable from the perspective that I'm going to present it. So I think, like I gave an example, right? You know, if we have two features that clearly solve a problem for the user, they are like mandatory, and then there is a third optional feature that, you know, may work or may not. So basically you're trying to make a case not to build that feature, right? And you have this number 50% that you just brought up, which I believe is, you know, well researched and supported by data from those IE.com engineers, right? So, and what you can do, like if you do the research and you find either similar products or, you know, some kind of products that can show you that they were first released with a certain number of features, but then some features were either reworked or they were removed and things like that. And then you can kind of build the case and saying, hey, based on my research, there is a high chance that this third feature that you guys want to add so bad may not work. And so if our project, our developers' total cost for this project is, let's say, you know, 300 grand, then by taking this 50% number, you'll say, so the probability that this third feature may fail is, you know, 75%, which is a pretty high probability. So if that happens, you can take that 50% number and you can say, you guys might be looking at another 150 grand of additional investment to rework or remove that feature, because, you know, removing a feature may not just be removing that from the UI. You know, it can be interconnected in the database and whatnot. So it can actually, removing can actually cost a lot of time. So I think that's a really good way to kind of end that, because that 50% number is pretty, and obviously, you know, it depends on the project, and I would be interested to understand what kind of math is behind that 50% number. But at least at the high level, nobody will ever, you know, calculate the super precise CBA cost-benefit analysis. Right. But I think kind of taking that 50% and knowing the costs of your project organization, you know, as I said, just off the top of my head, let's say it costs you 300 grand to build a product. And you can say, based on your research, that third feature may come back, backfire at us. And you might be looking at additional 150 grand to rework or remove that. So I think, between all the money that you will spend by, you know, losing customers to competitors, calling your tech support, which again translates into money, reworking the product, which, you know, you have this 50% number, and obviously if you have more reworks, then you can kind of keep extrapolating that number in the future. But there are so many costs, and if you get the UX right, you will save enormous amount of money. And you know, the reason the decisions are made against good UX is probably such numbers never make it to the desk of people who make executive decisions, or it just has to do with incentives, where people might be presented with numbers like that, but they just have their own agendas. They care about their bonuses and quarterly results and delivering products on a specific day. I actually remember a phrase from one of the managers at Ameriprise. It was not about UX, but it was about delivering our financial analysis. They said, you can delay the date, but you never deliver an unfinished product. So for example, if you say the CEO at Ameriprise makes, you know, a lot of money, and his time is very valuable, and decisions he may make based on the numbers can be, you know, multi-billion-dollar decisions. And in order to, even if you promise them that you will deliver it by Friday night, but you, something didn't make sense in the numbers, or you found some other piece of information that you need to build into the analysis, which will cause a lot of rework, and it will take you another week, it's, you never deliver a bad product. I mean, that was kind of my training, and I really appreciate it. And I think this same thing should translate into UX as well, where, you know, if you have a slightest doubt that it will be bad user experience, you should just, you know, even if you promised, you should just apologize and take more time. So,
right, yeah,
those are my thoughts.
It's like Shigeru Miyamoto, who is famous for video games, specifically Nintendo, said a delayed game is eventually good, but a bad game is bad forever. So,
yeah, exactly, and
it's that same sort of concept.
Yeah.
Well, so, yeah, and thank you very much for having me on today. You know, I really appreciate you taking some time with me, and, you know, we'll definitely do this again here soon. For anybody that wants to find out more about me, you can find me on Twitter at Doug Collins UX, and, of course, you can go to DenverUXer.com. How can they find you if they're wanting to find out more information about you?
Well, if they are listening to the podcast, it links to my profile, so I would hope.
Yeah, so check out the description and review the podcast.
I put your links in the description as well. So.
Oh, hey, well, I feel great about that. Well, and definitely review the podcast, people. You know, please, you know, wherever you're listening to us, you know, if you're listening to this on a platform that allows reviews, leave us a 5-star review. It doesn't really have anything to do with our egos. You know, the better reviews we get, the more we sort of work our way up. It's more of a business thing and listener thing, but we would really appreciate that. It would be a great compliment to both of us, and especially for the time that you put in and the effort you put into this. Like I said, I'm the one winging it, so you've definitely earned it. So I hope people will do that and leave you some good reviews and you know, find us on Twitter, give us some good feedback, let us know what you'd like to hear. So that we can talk about that. And you know, we are, as we say, user-driven, data-driven people. So you are our users. And the more we hear from you, the better we can make a podcast in the future.
Awesome. Yeah. Nothing to add. Another great ending from Doug. thank you for tuning in, guys. And sorry we rolled over 1 hour. So hopefully it's not a problem. Hopefully, you know, every minute is worth it, or, you know, most minutes. Don't want to be, you know, too ambitious. but yeah, thank you for tuning in, and leave us feedback. I mean, we already got some feedback on our first episode from a few people, and it helped a lot. Yeah, thank you for tuning in, and we really appreciate your time. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.